committee will come to order. Members, we have a few bills on the agenda for today. Some have financial impacts and some don't. Senator Roebling's bill does not have financial impact. It's a policy bill only. Senator Roebling has Senate File 405, which is a game bird and waterfowl definition for purposes of property taxes. Senator Roebling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have a fairly simple bill today. It was brought to me by a constituent in Newmarket Township who raises game birds, which he sells for some to zoos because some are exotic. Some he sells to the DNR. And he also, he sent a little note. I don't know if it's in your pack or not. It's from Greg Teschany. And he has been doing this for a number of years, and he's licensed both federally and in the state to sell game birds. But we found out, going through the law, that his operation does not qualify for agricultural status or classification under current law. Right now in law, it says that if you're raising game birds and waterfowl bred and raised for use on a shooting preserve that is licensed through the state, then you can qualify for the agricultural classification. But he raises at least 1,000 birds a year, and he doesn't fall under this classification. So he was going to be classified as commercial. And so we're just trying to change it. We did get a fiscal note on it. They said that the number of people who would fall under this classification would be rather negligible. And so we do have to offer an amendment, though, to clarify it a little further, because we want to make sure that we just include those operations that are licensed, which would be the larger operations and would exclude people who just raise birds for a hobby. And so if I could, I have the A50 amendment?
A1. A1 amendment.
Oh, the A1 amendment.
Members, Senator Roebling referred to Mr.
Teschany.
Mm-hmm. And it is in your packet right behind the fiscal note. Our page is just handing out the A1 amendment, Senator Roebling. And do you have it in front of you?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair.
Do you want to explain what the amendment does, Senator Roebling?
What the amendment actually does is hone in on those that are licensed. Before, when the original language was drafted, it just said game birds and waterfowl, those raising game birds and waterfowl. But we thought that we don't want to include people who have 10 pheasants in a little pen in the backyard or 10 mallard ducks or something on their pond. We wanted to make sure that they were actually an operation where that could be classified as agricultural, a bigger operation. And so anyone who sells game birds has to be licensed in the state of Minnesota and federally, especially for any migratory birds. And so this just hones in on that.
And Senate Council is advising that what we're doing is actually putting back stricken language. And so if you would, Ms. Off, just explain how that works.
Madam Chair, members, additionally, the amendment reinstates the language in the current law that was stricken in this bill, so it ensures that those game and waterfowl that are raised on a licensed shooting preserve will continue to get the exemption in addition to this new category.
Thank you. And members, the A1 amendment is an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author would wish. And so this is his first hearing, is it not, Senator Roebling?
Yes, this is his first hearing.
We'll just take up the A1 first, Senator Howell.
I would move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Howell moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author would wish. Questions or comments about the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted. Questions or comments for Senator Roebling about the bill? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Roebling, this is all welcome to the property tax exemptions. What is the cost of a license? What I'm trying to wonder about is, will there be individuals that'll have 10 birds and get a license to get the ag classification rate on their home?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I am not sure. I I'm thinking it's about $100, but I know that you have to have someone from the DNR come out and do an inspection of your property, and there are some conditions involved with it. You have to get a receipt book to show that you're selling licensed birds. I can't say for sure that I know the cost of the license.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Skoyne.
Thank you. You know, we kind of went around and around with the horses on this same issue, and I see that game birds and waterfowl were currently already in law, which I wasn't aware of, but I don't know how this fits into the food and fiber production part of agriculture. I mean, game birds for zoos, you know, obviously doesn't fit into the agriculture definition, and these folks are going to get a pretty significant property tax reduction, and I'm wondering what the rationale for them to shift their property taxes onto their neighbors is.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoyne, apparently they had been classified as agricultural in the past, so it isn't really a shift. It was just discovered that they were not qualified under current law. The county, I believe, had been assessing them as agricultural in the past, and you know, all of a sudden the shift came and they're going to move them to commercial, and the change in classification meant, of course, a very large change in property tax rates for the individual. And actually we have Mr. Dipping from the county assessors.
Yes, he's from the Minnesota Association of Assessors, Assessing Officers from Houston County. Mr. Dipping, welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, MAAO certainly supports bringing back into the language the licensing. Our biggest concern was if you had someone, obviously with a few chickens or a few ducks in the backyard, they would be coming to us all the time trying to gain that agricultural classification. So our concern was when the language was stricken on here, that would come back into play.
And so then the author's amendment really corrected your concerns, Mr. Dibby?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I know that to address Senator Skoyne's concern, even if you are selling your birds like your mallards or your pheasants for consumption, you still need a game license anytime that you are selling game birds. And so some people do sell them for consumption, and that would still be an eligible use, of course.
Other questions or comments for Senator Roebling? And members, if it sounds like I'm raising my voice, it's not because of your bill, Senator Roebling, or anything else. It's that the microphone isn't working here, so we're working on another one. So, Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, I think to Senator Skoyne's part, we just all need to be aware of the fact that for somebody who wants to get a license and participate in some of this, maybe selling birds to their neighbor, they're going to cut their property taxes in half on their home, not on their agricultural property, but on their home. So just want people to be aware of that in the event 3 or 4 years down the road that we start to hear from assessors that a lot of people are using this as a way to cut their property tax obligations in half, also avoid school operating levies, which I don't believe, Senator Skoyne, I don't believe we pay on ag property either. So there's a hole, you can drive a pretty big truck through here if people decide they want to start using it for the cost of whatever a license is to sell some birds to their neighbors. Just want people to be aware of it.
I'll ask Ms. Daw, Senator Bach, to just clarify that. Which portion would they be exempt from? It's for a referendum?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's for the referendums on the school, or for school purposes that are from which agricultural land is exempt.
Madam Chair.
Good point, Senator Bach. Senator Skoyne.
Madam Chair, it would be the voter-approved referendums.
Right.
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, doesn't it exclude a house in 1 acre?
Ms. Zoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it applies to the agricultural land, the exemption from the referendum levies for the schools.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator
and Ms. Zoff, if they had just a regular home in a residential area or something, and they had less than an acre, they wouldn't be able to receive that benefit, would they?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if the agricultural land, in most cases, unless it's an intensive use, you have to have at least 10 acres, and then it's the land that is subject to the separate ag treatment. Typically, the home, garage, and 1 acre that are on an ag homestead are treated the same as other homesteads, non-ag homesteads.
Thank you.
Well, and is that your intent, Senator Roebling?
Senator Ortman, I am, you know, I don't want to have happen what Senator Bach suggested, and if it does, we'll have to come back and change it. We'll have to put in some larger category, or, you know, say they have to have 1,000 birds or do something that would make sure that they're not abusing it. I'm hopeful that it wouldn't be abused, but we want to make sure it isn't.
Well, and Senator Roebling, are you maybe willing to work on this further to try and make sure that there is no room for abuse in what you're trying to accomplish here now? Or are you hoping that we'll move forward with it and then address that concern if it occurs?
Madam Chair, you know, maybe we should think of putting some kind of a quantity in to make sure that we don't have somebody trying to use it for a smaller number of birds. And I don't know what that would be, what number would be appropriate. You know, I would guess several hundred, 500. I'm not sure.
Well, Senator,
but then we leave the assessor counting birds, and I don't know if that's a good idea either. I'm not sure how we would handle it.
Well, Senator Roebling, I'll defer to you as to whether you want us to act on this now or whether in the next hour or so you might want to work on some kind of language that would protect against exactly what Senator Bach's looking at, or whether you want to come back and deal with it if it becomes a problem after the fact. We are going to be here until 10. We do have to adjourn at 10 o'clock today, and so if you want to make some changes, I would give you time to do that if you want.
I can look at it. I have some expert counsel here to help me. So maybe we could work out something that we think might be feasible.
I think that's a good idea, Senator Roebling. And so, Senator Hoffman, would you move to lay this bill on the table, and we'll take it up if and when Senator Roebling is ready to make any changes?
Okay.
All those in favor of Senator Hoffman's motion to lay this bill on the table signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The bill is on the table, Senator Roebling. Let us know.
Okay.
Okay, we also have with us Senator Gazelka. And Senator Gazelka has Senate File 829, modifying the penalties for late payment of property taxes. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Gazelka. Have you been here before us before?
Madam Chair, I think once before.
Once before, so you're an expert, and we can be hard on you if necessary, right? We can throw all those tough questions at you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'm getting more tired as the days go on, so I get just as cranky.
You'll fit right in, Senator Gazelka. All right, so Senator, will you explain the intent of your bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, Senate File 829 is a bill that, after visiting with Representative Mike Lemure, I wanted to carry forward on the Senate side. A local county auditor approached him and said, as he was having a hard time explaining to small business owners that came in that happened to have a late penalty on their property taxes, why they had to pay more than a homeowner with basically property. And so they suggested making the change. And so what this bill does, it makes several changes to penalties for late payments of property taxes. The late payment for the first half property taxes for non-homestead property taxes, 4% until May 31st and 8% on June 1st is stricken. The penalty for late payment of first half property taxes of 2% until May 31st and 4% on June 1st. So they're lowering that slightly, but then also saying that it applies to all property tax types, not just homestead, but also business property taxes as well. And so...
Senator Gazelka, thank you. I think it makes sense to have one standard for everybody. I think that's what you're trying to accomplish here. Where do the penalties go now? Do they, if they're late on property taxes, do the local counties keep the penalties?
Yes, it goes back to the local county. I know it would impact school board, or the funding that would go to schools as well. But in my mind, I had a business owner approach me and say, you know, I came back to pay my property taxes from vacation. I was 30 minutes late. I had to pay a $500 penalty, and you know, that kind of got me thinking, this is not, you know, it's not fair, you know. And so I know we're going to have testimony here against this, but I think as you look at it, I think people are struggling, whether it's a homeowner right now or a small business owner, they're all struggling. And if we can help them and make it fair, then I think that's a good thing to do.
Well, and Senator Gazelka, why 2%?
That's the House language, and I was comfortable with that.
Okay, and members, the language that Senator Gazelka has is in the House tax omnibus bill.
Yeah.
There is a fiscal note, and that's pretty new, though. So I think that when they passed that, they didn't have the information that has just come out with a fiscal note, which is, I'm a little puzzled by the fiscal note since we're talking about local penalties that are paid locally, but Ms. Von Mosch is with us, and she might be able to explain what was taken into consideration with this, and then maybe we can address it after.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair, and I'd appreciate that. I had the fiscal note from the House, which was zero, and then suddenly we have a higher one, and I think I'd rather have someone else explain it.
Thank you. Ms. Von Mosch, thank you for
Madam
helping
Chair,
us.
Members. The revenue estimate from the Department of Revenue did not have any cost. However, there was a fiscal note that was published on April 15th. That was after we had the conference committee spreadsheet together, which included this item on the House side. So on the House side of that spreadsheet right now, this item is listed as unknown. And what is going on here is that the bill is revenue neutral for school districts, but it does have an impact for the state, not for the tax revenues, but for money that affects school aides. Interest penalties are included in a city apportionment or in county apportionment under a provision in Minnesota statute where the county auditor apportions to school districts their share of proceeds from power line taxes, penalties on real estate taxes, which is the provision in this bill, and miscellaneous fees and fines. And since this bill reduces the penalties collected, the school districts would be receiving less in the county apportionment revenue, resulting in a cost to the state, because then the state would make up that reduction in aid. And so we do have a fiscal note that shows a cost in fiscal year 14 and 15 of $4.3 million in each year. And this would be an item, since this is in the conference committee bill right now without a cost, this would be an item that would have to be discussed within the conference committee, too, as this item is brought forward.
Ms. Von Mosch, is this essentially an interaction?
Madam Chair, it's kind of an interaction in that it is a statute that is the statutory reference is in the education system funding system area, and so it is one of those interactions that happens between in this case the tax laws that affect penalties and education funding.
Thank you. Members, questions or comments for either Ms. Von Mosch about the fiscal note or Senator Gazelka? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, could you explain on that? Those sound like pretty significant penalties. Are we looking at some of these penalties where they're properties that are just accruing penalties that are going to eventually be tax forfeited that the owner has just walked away or the developer has walked away on? Or how are these actual dollars that when we talk about the $4.3 million, is that dollars is actually covered that people actually pay or just is going on the books?
Ms. Von Mosch.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I am not able to answer your first question, and maybe someone from the department or someone who works with county auditors is more able to answer the first part of your question. What I know about the fiscal note is that the Department of Education did a survey of counties both within the metro area and non-metro, and they, as with most fiscal notes, these are based on some of the information that they gathered, and then they made some assumptions about how that might be applied around the state. And so they are assuming that this would have a statewide impact of reducing the penalties would have a statewide impact of $23.9 million in reduced penalties. That was the number that they came up with.
Thank you.
Is that
Senator
an annual,
Howell?
Madam Chair, is that an annual number?
Ms. Van Mosch.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yes, I believe that's an annual number.
Thank you. I understand Keith Carlson is here and would like to testify about this bill. Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a handout.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I appear in opposition to this bill. As Ms. Van Mosch has already identified, there's a $4.3 million cost to the state's general fund as a result of the reduction in the what's called the county apportionment, which is an offset against the state's general education aids to the school districts. An identical amount is what the counties would lose under this bill. Basically, penalties on regular property tax payments are split half and half between the school districts and the counties under current law. There would be additional cost to the cities because the penalties on late special assessments go exclusively to the cities or the entity, generally the cities that levy them. Our larger concern is that the current penalties are basically set up as not a penalty to non-homestead properties, but sort of a break consistent with the practices across the property tax system to homeowners. Our penalties are high, basically to prevent the local governments from being the banker of last resort to individuals. The table that I've passed out basically indicates how this works. The first two columns are the current rates, the date that you should anticipate that these payments are made basically one day before the dates indicated has the payment date. Then over on the right-hand side, I've put the current interest rates for Chase Visa, the 11.99% being the best rate to the most creditworthy customers, the 22.99% being the rate given to those with the worst credit, assuming they can still get it. These do not take into account additional costs that are levied by the credit card company for cash advances, for late payment penalties, or for the effects of the minimum payment requirements. You'll see for the least creditworthy customers, if they tried to affect basically the same as they had done by not paying the penalty, by if you enact this bill by the time you get to August 1st, or basically being roughly 2.5 months late in your property tax payment, if you lower the penalty rate to the equivalent of the homestead rate, it basically pays you to be delinquent on your property taxes rather than trying to finance your cash problems by taking a loan through your Visa card. Again, these really understate the cost of by taking a loan through a Visa because there are additional charges above and beyond the annual percentage rate. And so While the revenue analysis shows this $4.3 million cost, our fear is that this doesn't represent the full potential effect on local governments because now there's, for anybody who looks at it closely, which I anticipate most businessmen will, they'll see that there's an incentive to basically use local governments as their banker rather than going to other credit sources available to them currently. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Gazelka, your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, it's not just local businessmen, Madam Chair. It would be homeowners as well. But and I don't know if we know how many are simply late, which means they're not trying to milk it out to the very end to save interest, but come back and make a payment, whether it's a day or a week later. All of those people, as I understand it, are paying that full 2% or whatever the percentage is right away up front, so it's not really a true annual yield.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes to my mind is we're talking now about the costs to the county or the schools instead of what the penalty should be for a late payment. We're talking about a different issue. It's about how do we recapture the revenue as opposed to how much should a late property taxpayer pay in its penalty. And so for that, I appreciate the jolt in this committee. What's the right penalty as opposed to how much do we capture in revenue? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I just had a question maybe the testifier can answer. Do any counties take Visa or MasterCard or Discover or American Express for the property taxes? I mean, is that an option for these business owners other than a cash advance type?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator, many counties do allow Visa has a means of payment, but there is a service charge that's attached to that, generally in the neighborhood of 2% to 2.5%. Varies from county to county, so there is a financial disincentive to do that, but it is an option that's available to taxpayers in many counties.
Well, and Mr. Carlson, that was adopted in Carver County when I was on the county board, and one of the problems with that is that all taxpayers then pay for those service charges, not the taxpayer that's borrowing against the Visa. I mean, it's an interesting dynamic and one that the county boards have struggled with about whether they should take credit cards for services and things like that. Senator Howe, other thoughts on this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I like the equal treatment, aspect of it and the conformity of it. But I would also be concerned about, the other issues on the revenue side. So.
Well, I have good news for you, Senator Gazelka, which is it's in the House Tax Omnibus Bill. And so regardless of what happens today, it will be considered by the Tax Conference Committee. And I think it's a good proposal. It does, unfortunately, have some financial ramifications. And we don't have any targets yet in that committee, so we don't know where we're at financially. And so it's still under consideration regardless. Other thoughts, questions, comments from members? Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, did I hear Ms. Von Mosch right that she said the House was carrying this provision in their bill and is carrying no cost on the spreadsheet to the State General Fund?
Well, Senator Bach, the fiscal note came out after they prepared the comparisons and the side-by-sides and spreadsheets. It's an April 15th fiscal note, so it came out pretty late after the fact. So, okay. Senator Gazelka, your guidance here today, should we lay this bill on the table for possible consideration at a future date?
Madam Chair, that would be my suggestion.
Senator, how would you like to make that motion to lay the bill on the
Madam
table?
Madam Chair, I'll move that motion.
Senator Howe moves to lay the bill on the table. We're talking about Senate File 829. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted, and 829 is laying on the table. Thank you, Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, members, have a great day.
We have Senator Tomasoni, who has a bill regarding St. Louis County and the tax status of fairgrounds. Senator Tomasoni, it's been a few years since you've been on this committee, but your presence is missed, I have to say. You are a strong presence when I served with you many years ago.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to hear that. I appreciate that. I take that as a compliment. Madam Chair, Senate File 867 is a pretty simple bill. It does two things. It allows St. Louis County to eliminate an obsolete provision that only allowed the county to spend $2,000 on county fairs. This provision apparently went back to 1913. And so it makes sense to eliminate that. And the other part of the bill just clarifies the tax-exempt status of the fairgrounds in St. Louis County. There's several fairground facilities in St. Louis County, and this makes these facilities tax-exempt like every other county fair in the state. And the only difference in St. Louis County is the county doesn't own the land where these are, and in every other county, the counties do own the land. So this is... It's just a fairness issue.
Senator Thomas Oney, a very wise senator, told me that if you don't want to be heard, you mumble. And if you want to be heard, you need to speak up into the microphone. So, Senator Thomas Oney, you might want to speak a little more loudly, because I think people are going to like what you have to say here. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you said.
You're correct, Senator Marty.
I was curious who does own the property that it's used exclusively for the county fair. Who does own it?
Madam Chair and members, John Ungaro.
Mr. Ungaro. Welcome.
Thank you. Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. Actually, we have a myriad of different owners because we have a total of 4 county fairs in St. Louis County. Of course, much of that has to do with the fact that we're the largest county in the United States geographically east of the Mississippi River. So that's one of the reasons anyways why we have a total of 4 county fairs. And the reason why this is appearing in this bill is because the Department of Revenue certainly, when they went back a few years ago and looked at various nonprofit organizations and wanted to get them to verify their tax-exempt status, they certainly didn't want to have any county fairgrounds suddenly to start paying property taxes. And so when it came out, the fact that because the county doesn't own the land where these various county fairs are held, that instead of trying to remedy it through the legislation that passed a few years ago, they felt that the simplest way would be to amend the St. Louis County statute that is currently in place, and that's why the remedy that's here today is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Ungaro, are they owned by nonprofits? Are they owned by cities? Who owns the
property? Primarily cities or other government entities. For example, the main county fair is actually on IRRRB property.
Thank you. Senator Bach, other questions or comments for Senator Thomas Oney or Mr. Ungaro? Are there folks here that would like to testify either for or against Senator Thomas Oney's proposal? Senator Thomas Oney, I would hope that we could lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the policy bill since there are no fiscal ramifications for the state. Are you aware of any or a fiscal note that has any impact at all?
None that I know of, Madam Chair.
All right.
Or you can put it on the consent calendar if you would like.
Well, Senator Thomas Oney, without further objection, I'm going to mumble now. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Thomas Oney. Senator Scoy, if I could ask you to defer, because Senator Bonoff is here and all the folks are here to testify in support of her bill. And Senator Bach, Senator Howe, hopefully you'll defer to Senator Bonoff while she's here with her many testifiers. Senator Bonoff, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If I could introduce your bill very briefly, I'm going to let you explain what it does, but remember, so you know, the House version of Senator Bonoff's bill is in the House tax omnibus bill, and it has been already discussed yesterday in our first real substantive committee, and we've had conversations about this and how it relates to our TIF bills, because there are some aspects of this that mirror that. It gives some local folks an opportunity to do some granting and for new businesses in local communities. So with that, members, it is in consideration in the Tax Conference Committee already. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rosen, who's here, I also want to acknowledge because she is a strong partner on this bill, and I am pleased to be working with her. So we are here today to discuss something that is more fun than looking at should we do revenue, should we do cuts, how does reform solve our budget problems. We talk about that the most popular way to solve our budget problem is to actually have economic growth. And this bill is about economic growth. It's about identifying a sector that we believe is not only growing but can allow Minnesota to emerge strong in our future economic recovery. And that is the creation of the Science and Technology Authority. This authority was created in law last session. It is part of now a strong public and private partnership. I am joined with me at the table today by the Executive Director of the Science and Technology Authority, Betsy Loftus, as well as John Alexander, who is the President of the Business Development Advisors, the Chairman of the Twin Cities Angels Treasury Funds, Minnesota Science and Technology Authority Task Force member. So given they are here at the table to accompany me, I will let them speak about the authority, its importance, and the strategic way in which we are going forward with this initiative. I would like the members to understand that in today's bill, we have identified a way to fund the initiatives that we do plan on proceeding with in the authority, and so that's why we're here in the Tax Committee, because there is a creative mechanism for funding, and after they have a chance to talk about the authority, I will briefly speak about that mechanism, and it will be up to the committee to decide whether, in fact, that mechanism is something that we do want to use going forward. So with that, I will turn it over to Betsy Loftus.
Senator Michaud.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. Before your all-stars get going here, I just wanted to make sure that I have a clear understanding because there's two pieces involving the Science and Tech Authority. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to keep this brief. There's a piece in the Jobs Conference Committee now that involves some funding, and I'm maybe incorrectly giving this the name of a second piece, but just so I understand kind of what's brewing around here in the next 3 weeks. Can you help me distinguish
Chair.
Between the two and
very
what
good.
We need to move forward?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Michel, we first were – this bill was heard in your committee because of its relationship to jobs. But if you recall, the way that we were funding these initiatives in this bill was to have a TIF mechanism where we took the taxable wage base of – the employees in the current technology sector, and we said that the growth going forward, up to 85% of that, was going to be used to be redirected to fund the initiatives that we'll be talking about today. So this bill is before the committee today to understand that funding mechanism. Now, actually, in the House, they chose to use a straight appropriation, which more would relate to what you're looking at. But overall, this is a jobs initiative.
And, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonoff, I think it's a straight appropriation in the tax bill. So I think that's in front of the tax conferees now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Everybody's nodding. So thank you for putting me on the same page.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Lufs. I'm the Executive Director of the Science and Technology Authority. And I just want to give you a little history of why the authority was created and why it's needed moving forward. Minnesota, if you look at the rankings, every state is recognized for the rankings on where they fall in job growth and creation. So if you look at the fact that we are number one in the country for Fortune 500s per capita, we rank first in the country. Yet when it comes to entrepreneurial activity, we rank 42nd. That is a huge gap for small businesses as they're starting up, especially in the science and technology sector. They have different issues that need to be addressed. Sometimes it takes longer time to get their products commercialized. So So the advisory commission is made up of industry, heavy in industry, small and large industry, as well as the University of Minnesota, Minsky System, Mayo Clinic, and the trade organizations that everyone is aware of, Life Science Alley, BioBusiness Alliance, Defense Alliance, Minnesota High Tech Association. So these leaders came together, and the authority was created last July, and the leaders came together and spent 6 months donating hundreds of hours to create our strategic plan that said we recognize there are huge gaps in the system. There is no one truly focusing on growing high-tech entrepreneurs as far from the investment side. So the authority decided that, or the advisory commission said, we are going to look at this as being an investment, a pre-investment, pre-seed opportunity, because no one in the state was addressing that need. Other groups are doing famous jobs of helping entrepreneurial companies, but no one was addressing the need to help these high-tech entrepreneurs. Any of you that have met with high-tech entrepreneurs, and this is not disparaging, there are scientists and engineers, and they don't necessarily want to deal with the business side of the house. So how do we take that expert intelligence with this product that is going to save lives or save time or save energy? And how do we transfer that into a viable business opportunity? And to do that, they need help from the business side. They also need gap funding. And many of you have already heard, I'm sure, of the Valley of Death. It is not unique to Minnesota. It is all over the world. It's not even just the United States. So with a little bit of investment, seed investment, that would be leveraged. It's either leveraged 1-to-1 or 1-to-5 or 1.75, 1-to-2. Whatever we decide it's going to be, leveraging them to get either, A, their product to market, or, B, leverage additional federal funding. We had two initiatives in our strategic plan. One $10,000 investment leveraged a $3 million grant, and another an $80,000 investment was matched by $120,000, and it leveraged 9 new jobs. So we're looking for a little pre-seed money to help grow these companies. The programs that the advisory commission have decided that we will initially start with, because we're looking, this is a long-term investment. This is a 10-year program to start. We're looking at a technology commercialization fund, which would be that seed stage funding that would be leveraged to move a product forward. We're looking at creating a business entrepreneurship accelerator, which is that hands-on expertise to guide these companies through the process. And interestingly enough, sometimes they find out that your product will not be viable in the market, and this business entrepreneurship accelerator will help them do that. And the other thing is, it's said many, many times, how do we keep the best and the brightest here? We're looking at funding an internship program. Other states have funded an internship program, and you give these students an opportunity. It would be leveraged by match from the industry. You're giving students an opportunity to stay here, because when you look at the rankings for quality of life, Minnesota ranks in top two most of the time, whether it's health or living here. So how do we invest in small businesses to keep them here in a long-term fashion, rather than doing a two-year cycle every time it comes around? So the authority was created as a standalone entity. There are 5 members of the authority. The commissioner of deed is the CEO. The other members are revenue, MMB, ag, and commerce. And those commissioners make up the authority and will help have fiduciary responsibility for what moves forward on investing in these companies to grow the economy in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Lopes. Mr. Alexander, go ahead.
Thank you very much. While I'm primarily here to answer questions. Oh, I'm sorry, John Alexander. While I'm primarily here to answer questions, from a business perspective, as one of the business members of the Science and Technology Authority, my perspective is this fills a much-needed gap between the money an individual entrepreneur takes out of their pocket and when a company or an idea is more fully developed, that stage in which angels bring in capital. At that very earliest stages, companies or ideas thrive based on friends, family, and federal grant money, typically called the 3 F's. What other states have done, and principally through pulling in the money from the tobacco settlement activity of a decade ago, is fund a variety of programs that assist technologically sophisticated individuals, be they interns in bachelor's, graduate, or postgraduate programs, fund gaps between funding between their ability to fund a company and an angel's ability to provide support, and then support for further federal grants in the term of SBIR grants, STTAR grants, or other types of NIH or other federal activity as a way to support those organizations as they move from the light bulb going off to the point where an investor can understand what the opportunity is, both in terms of the needs it meets in the marketplace and the economic activity that could result from them taking money out of their pocket and putting into this company. What those other states have done, Ohio and North Carolina, as noted examples, they've taken hundreds of millions and billions of over $1 billion in one case over the last decade in providing a wide variety of programs. At the Science and Technology Authority, committees have benchmarked those other states and taken a look at which of those programs have been most effective. We've learned on their nickel and have identified a subset of those programs where we think we can get the most bang for the buck. One of them, as Director Luft mentioned, is an internship program where we would match to a given level the funding to allow those students in science and engineering programs to work for companies that could not otherwise afford them. Gap funding that would allow some support while they're waiting for federal grants. Matching grants that would allow, you know, the 25 or 50 grand somebody takes out of a mortgage of their house in order to put into a particular company, in order to get them to the next milestone, so that those angels can understand what the opportunity might be. And this is why I'm a strong supporter of it. It's that earliest stage in the ecosystem, from the light bulb coming off to proof of principle being done, to the point where angels become interested, to the point where venture and large corporations become interested in the product. And what comes from science and technology, regardless of whether you're talking about IT or medical or defense or green, technology takes time to develop, and this provides that very earliest stage of support.
Thank you. Questions for the committee? Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering whether someone on the committee here or council or someone, a testifier, can give me a little better context to the back side of the Minnesota revenue sheet here, where it has the percentages and the percent of groups 2009 withholding. What is that, those percentages made up? Is that the percentages of their withholding or of what would be made up of the $25 million?
Somebody from revenue can comment on that. Is any, Mr. Mossman?
In the back room.
Mr. Chairman, Matt Mossman, Department of Revenue, and if you could repeat the question, I was in another.
Mr. Howe.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mossman, I was just wondering on the back side of the revenue sheet here, where it shows the percentages and the percent of groups 2009 withholding, could you give me some context to what that is there?
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe that this is looking at, obviously, at the breaking down the industry by its detailed level, and just showing the percentage of the of each of these subcategories in the industry. The percent of withholding for each of these subcategories in the industry in 2009. So
the withholding of their, Mr. Chair, is it the withholding of what their tax liability is?
Income tax withholding, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps to Senator Bonhoeff or anyone else.
I'm just trying to grasp this a little bit better. And so I'm going down to, line 319, for instance, and just kind of trying to understand how this works. And maybe 318, actually, where it says, the Commissioner of Management and Budget shall pay annually 85% of the increase in aggregate withholding taxes that are over the base year taxation amount. So that's taxes related to primary science and technology companies, which is probably another question, like who are they? I see they're identifiable by SIC code, but as you think about that, then so 85% of the aggregate withholding or increase in aggregate withholding taxes, what does that really mean in terms of is it an increase in taxes of what they paid in the base year over the new year, whatever that might be?
Madam Chair, and Senator, I do have Ward Ines, who's happy to answer more detailed questions, but yes, Senator Senjum, mm-hmm. we would look at a base year and what the employees' withholding tax amounted to, and that would become the floor. And then we would say that one of the things that's most important about this sector is that it has high growth potential. So we say that it would be a smart way for us to invest that revenue back into this sector because that's where we have a chance for exponential growth. So you take the base year and then the growth that perhaps was forecasted was not. We don't really, you know where we're going to end up with growth. And you say up to 85%, but no more than the $25 million, would be used to fund new startups and grants and matching grants in the way that the bill is structured. But where that money would come from would be taking the up to that percentage of incremental growth. And again, there was that's just one idea. Mm-hmm. Put forward. This committee may or may not choose to adopt that idea. In the House, they didn't choose to adopt it. I think it's a creative, interesting approach. Other states have tried it. And in terms of the technical questions, I would defer to Ward Ines to talk about that.
Madam Chair and Senator, maybe I can make this kind of sense. Just, I often like to think in terms of, for instances, so if, for instance, if a company had $1 million worth of withholding in the base year, and on a year subsequent, it was $1,100,000. Would then 85%, $85,000, then go into the fund for that year? Is it that simple?
Madam Chair, exactly. Yes.
Okay.
And we would stop doing that once we got to the so it would be on a prorated basis, but once we got to the $25 million, we would no longer take that growth.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, or Senator Senjum, I guess, on this thing, the way I look at it, I mean, it's sort of a decision to take an appropriation, put it into a tax expenditure thing. It's basically what we're doing is we're appropriating $25 million a year to this fund, and it sounds insane. We're taking it out of the new income tax withholding from those businesses. When I look at the revenue analysis detail, it said the base year, and I don't know if the bill says that the base year is 2009, but they say the withholding that year was $436 million. The previous year was $486 because of recession, I assume. So in effect, if we're back to 2008 numbers by now, you'd in effect have more than the $25 million right from the start. So we'd in effect just be appropriating $25 million a year unless the economy tanked and all the businesses paid less, then we would be capping it. And it seems to me if we decide it's worth $25 million a year to invest in this, we probably ought to appropriate $25 million instead of saying we're going to appropriate $25 million unless the revenue goes down. I think that's a fair statement of what's happening here. We're appropriating the $25 million from the state revenues, in theory, from these businesses. But if these businesses, and it should be at least $25 million available right away from the start, because we're in a dip now because of the recession.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that isn't actually accurate.
It's not 2008 you're starting with?
No, it's 2010 is the base year. And so we are betting on that this is a growth sector, and so there will be growth, but there are no guarantees.
So
Senator Marty.
So, Madam Chair, in other words, there's no the first few years, the fiscal impact in the revenue analysis is just an estimate of what they think there will be at least half of that amount by fiscal year 13 and will be over the $25 million by the next year. And then presumably from then on, it's automatic in effect.
Senator Bonner?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, maybe counsel can help me. On line 3.8, where it says the commissioner at MMB shall not commingle the money with other money. I can't remember seeing that before. Does that prevent interfund transfers for the state's cash flow purposes? And I think if it does, that's problematic. I mean, right now MMB moves money around among all the funds to make sure the state can pay its bills. And if that's true, then this committee needs to spend more time looking at this bill line by line, because that, I think, is inappropriate. Council, is that what it means?
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I assume that's what it's meant, so that money is set aside and is not available for any other use that could conceivably happen. And I'm not familiar with another instance where that language has come before this committee.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, let me just say it. I think most people know I'm against dedicated accounts. We create more and more dedicated accounts in state law. So what we're doing with this bill is moving this purpose ahead of anything else, that we're taking future income tax money and saying this is the most important thing the next legislature can do with that money, more important than public safety, more important than early childhood, more important than K-12, more important than nursing homes, because this is such a high use. We're going to take 85% of the income tax that's collected in this industry, and I think the sheet says up to 7,000 businesses, and that is the most important thing we can do with it. And I just think the next legislature, whoever that is, if this is a good idea, they should have to come back here and make the argument they're doing a good job, they're creating jobs, and argue for an appropriation like every other program has to. Come back here and show that you've been successful, not put yourself on automatic pilot in law where you automatically get 85% of the money, but come here and show the data that you're being successful, that it's a good investment of state general fund money. Get yourself in competition with everything else here over the legislative session and make your best argument for the money. And if you have a good story to tell, you're going to be successful, and you're going to get another state general fund appropriation. But to say that this program, and I care about its economic development as much as anybody in the room, is more important, that we're going to tell the next legislature that this is more important than anything else you're going to consider, I think is just a policy problem.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, that was actually the discussion that ensued in the House, which is why they ended up choosing to do it as an appropriation so that there was that check and balance to come back. Again, I'm not married to either approach. That was a creative approach that was included in this bill, but it's up to the will of the committee. I think what we ought to keep our eye on, and I appreciate your concern about that, but I think what I would ask the committee for the purposes of this too is to keep our eye on the importance of going forward strategically with this initiative this year, because I think in tough times we often hunker down and don't invest in what it's going to take to create future growth, and this isn't a chance to do that. And so if we decide to do it as an appropriation and have to come back every 2 years, that is completely fine with me. It's in line with the intent. With regard to the actual language, I think Executive Director Loft had a comment about that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, the Science and Technology Authority language is modeled after the Public Finance Authority. So the language, with some words changed for science and technology to address the industry needs, it's specifically modeled on what is currently, how the Public Finance Authority is currently addressed, if that helps answer your question for the commingling of the money. I'm not sure how Public Finance Authority, how their funds are set up, but this language is modeled on the PFA.
Well,
I tend to agree with Senator Bach that if we cut up the general fund pie every year and say we're going to collect funds and we're going to cut it up this way for all future purposes and we aren't going to collect these funds unless they're spent in a certain way, I think we've hamstrung ourselves unnecessarily. And it is our job to prioritize every dollar we spend around here. And if we're not prioritizing, I think we've got our priorities wrong. So I agree with Senator Bach, and I would prefer the house tax provision, which has a straight appropriation. If we're going to do it, let's just do it.
Yes.
I'm just speaking as one member here, Senator Bonoff, with my recommendation would be to find a way to do a straight appropriation. I've asked Senator Rosen to look into this and work with you on this as it advances through the tax conference committee. I think she's a very good advocate for this proposal, and I'm sure she'll work very hard to help accomplish all these folks' goals.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. That would be wonderful.
Senator Rosen, a comment or question?
The discussion we had yesterday in conference committee was centered around the jobs bill versus our jobs bill in the Senate versus their jobs bill in the House, which is basically this. So I think a compromise is in order, and we need to get it fine-tuned. But I think Senator Bach had another question, too, didn't you, about the...
Senator Bach?
Oh, I just mentioned to Senator Rosen, I don't understand why after, I think it says after 2 years, I don't understand how it's collateralized. I think if we're going to invest public taxpayers' dollars, our investment needs to be collateralized. And to allow a business after, is it 2 or 3 years, to be able to move out of the state and take a fourth of the money, the taxpayers' money that we gave them, I think is a problem. I think that window's way too narrow. There ought to be a longer term of time that a business has to be in this state and grow and add jobs. And then if it's 2 or 3 years, they can pack it up and move. And I just think it reads to me, just kind of scanning through it, there's a reason the angel investment bill took so many years to get done here. It went over a lot of scrutiny for a long, long time. I mean, these are public taxpayer dollars, and we need to make sure that they're adequately collateralized here, and I'm not sure that that's the case.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, I think we should always scrutinize taxpayer dollars, and I am disappointed that we don't look at every single dollar that we spend in terms of what is our ROI. And I would say that that is true for every public program that we offer, for all of the programs, whether they're in the education area, the health and human services area, and that this actually lays a foundation to get an ROI. It says that we can have an equity position if we invest money. It has a mechanism for being paid back. It has some protections with regard to companies moving. If you think the window isn't long enough, we're open to changing that. But I think to characterize the bill as not being respectful of the importance of using taxpayer dollar wouldn't be accurate and would be doing a disservice to the work of the public-private partnership that the Science and Technology Authority is.
Well, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I'm not being critical of their effort. They obviously wrote the bill because it is 100% what they want. And I think it's the legislature's job to scrutinize the proposal and to make sure that it meets with the scrutiny that public tax dollars should have. I think it's a very creative proposal, but it's obviously written by an industry. And, I mean, I understand that. People come here with a proposal all the time, but now it becomes the job. I just think it needs more work.
Well, and to add to that, I mean, I think clearly we don't have a Senate position on this. The House does have a position. And so now it's our challenge, Senator Rosen, Senator Bonoff, Senator Bach, to develop a Senate position that we can all be comfortable with, because what you can hear now is what happens if the Tax Conference Committee adopts the House view or some version of it. We could come back and have some real questions in the Senate when we come back with that report. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to work very hard to make sure we can have Senate support for a position on this bill. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think to Senator Bach, that the question about, you know, if the company can leave, relocate, that's on page 7. So we need to work on that. And just to bring this whole conversation back to the importance of a jobs bill. And so this, and I know in the conference committee that the Senate position is for a select number of communities that can have a jobs bill. This is actually statewide. And it took 10 years or so to work on the angel investment tax credit that actually Senator Dal Sam started. He worked on it. I worked on it very hard. Senator Salzman worked on it. It's because we were not sure where the bioscience industry in Minnesota was at. And so where we've started 10 years ago to where we are now is tremendous in the growth in the biotechnology area. And so this is the next step that we need to take to continue on this. I mean, we have it right here. We just need to get this gap funding started and to give it a little boost. So this is definitely a bill that needs some work to make everybody comfortable with it. But I absolutely think it's doable, and it's the right approach for job creation and job growth in this state.
Thank you.
So I'd be more than happy to work on it.
Thank you. Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lips, was there any money involved in the authority when it was set up?
Ms. Lips.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, no. I had carry-forward money, so the initiative was set up. I was able to hire one other person because I was doing a couple different jobs, and to be able to focus on the policy and the recommendations for what the program, the authority would be when it was created and how it would address the gap funding. So as we had carry forward money that will expire at the end of June, and we will go back to the original budget of $107,000 starting July 1. If, as we stand today, that is what the recommendation has been made.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller.
And the original budget of 107 was for the Office of Science and Technology?
Ms. Luft.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, correct.
Members. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, $107,000 was the budget that I was given 6 years ago when the Small Business Innovation Research, Small Business Technology Transfer Program was brought into state government. And I looked around and I was shocked that the state of Minnesota did not have an entity that addressed entrepreneurial growth in the science and technology sectors and bringing industry and academia and government together. They did it in different ways. I mean, they funded the Genomics Partnership. There's different funds that have gone out there, but there was no coordinating entity to say this is how we are going to address this initiative for the state. And so the Office of Science and Technology was created, and I received one-time funding of $400,000 the first time. The second time I received funding was $200,000 a year. I used that funding to create small programs to try to show return on investment. And we did it in a very, very small way, but that funding that I carried forward is going to expire June 30th.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Bonoff,
it should be noted that the High Tech Association is here today with me. The Thomson Reuters representative, Ward Innes, is here today. That there is strong, strong public-private partnership for this initiative, and people are very excited about this prospect of this moving forward.
Well, thank you, Senator Bonoff. Members, I'm going to ask Senator Rosen to lay this bill on the table. And she's also got a copy of the amendment that would put this bill in the order that the House has. And so she can take that under advisement, work with you, Senator Bonoff, and maybe help us to craft an amendment that can earn Senate support. And we will be back in this committee again on Wednesday, May 4th, and so that may give you an opportunity and a timeline for developing your position and helping us to craft one. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I move that. Do we need to have a little briefing on the bio industry in Minnesota at some point? I mean, we just really never touched on it in the testimony here as far as where we've been and where we've gone. I don't know if that's something that we need to talk about at some point. Perhaps maybe in conference committee we can just talk about it. Would that
Senator
be okay?
Senator Rosen, I would defer to you whether you want to have that conversation in the conference committee or here in the tax committee as you develop a Senate position on this.
That'd be great.
And maybe you and Senator Bonoff can work on how you want to present this next and where.
Okay.
But I think for now, if we lay this bill on the table, it gives you an opportunity to work on a Senate position and also work in the Tax Conference Committee.
That'd be great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the A1 amendment for Senate File 300 be laid over for possible inclusion. Or just laid over. just lay it out on the-
I think we should lay over the bill unless you want to adopt the House amendment right now. But I would encourage you to just lay the bill on the table in its current form, and then you can decide how you want to shape it going forward.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just moved that Senate File 300 be laid over.
Thank you. It is not a debatable motion. All those in favor of Senator Rosen's motion to lay Senate File 300 on the table signify by saying aye. All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted, and Senate File 300 is on the table. All right, we have three other very quick bills. We have to be done at 10 o'clock today. We have one for Senator Skoy, one for Senator Bach, and one for Senator Howe. I'm going to ask Senator Skoy to go next. And members, again, we do have our next committee hearing will be on May 4th, and we have Senate File 646, which is Senator Hand's PEEP bill, Senate File 652, Senator Chamberlain's tax amnesty bill, and a couple of pretty bills that we've heard before, Senate File 857 and 872. I'm the chief author, and they are bills that we've heard before, the Wisconsin Reciprocity and the General Fund Checkoff. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, I'm here with Senate File 1156. Senate File 1156 deals with properties that use income in finding their value for property tax assessment. When property taxes are assessed using income, they can be anything from large businesses in the downtown Minneapolis area to a strip mall on the side of town. If the property tax owner appeals or contests the valuation, there has been some question about the information that the assessors could require from the property tax owner and the timelines that that information had to be provided. The stakeholders have been working the last few months to clarify that. We have representatives from the Minnesota Bar. Nick Fura is here. He's a property tax attorney. He would be representing the property owner. We have representatives from the Minnesota Association of Assessors, Steve Baker, and from the Minnesota County Attorney's Office, Lisa Hand Cordes. I think they're all here to tell us that with the work that they've done the last few months, they have found resolution to what information should be provided and the timelines that that should be provided. I think if you look at the bill, you'll see that there's been some clarification that the financial statements would be for 1 year only as opposed to more than 1 year's financial statements, and the timelines are being clarified as of August 1st, I believe, and a number of other changes. But if you wish, Madam Chair, the testifiers are here. I think they're here to lend support for their work that they've done finding some agreement on this issue.
Thank you. Senator Skoy, a question. Do you have an amendment that you want to offer?
Yes.
The A1 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for reminding me. Yes. As we've worked on this, there have been a few relatively technical changes that we found needed to be made. And so I would like to offer the A1 amendment, if I could, Madam Chair.
And members, this is the first hearing on this bill, and so as a courtesy to Senator Skoy, I hope you'll support his A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
And now we'll hear from Mr. Nick Furia from the State Bar Association. Mr. Furia.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, this bill is the result of a lot of effort from three sides that deal with this on a daily basis. Property tax lawyers such as myself file hundreds of these appeals a year, thousands in fact. So the property tax bar through the State Bar Association has worked for a long time very hard with the assessors, with the county attorneys to agree on this language. We have literally gone through dozens and dozens of revisions to get this just right. Basically, what it does is it clears up some problems that have arisen in Minnesota tax court decisions and Minnesota Supreme Court decisions with regard to what information has to be produced by my clients, the taxpayers, when they contest the valuations of their income-producing property, be it a hotel, a strip center, an office mall. This is In the past, this statute has been interpreted to be somewhat limitless in scope. What this bill does is it makes it an exhaustive list. You're going to look through here and you're going to see clauses one through six. That is to be exhausted. Now the taxpayer is on notice. Their attorney is on notice with regard to what they actually have to turn over to the assessor. The penalty here for not turning this over is automatic dismissal. So when we're talking about something that serious, it's extremely important to have an exhaustive list. After years, this is what we've come up with. Everybody agrees to it. 3-4 years ago, the assessors, the taxpayers, lawyers, and the county attorneys were not on the same page. So that's essentially what this does, and generally maintains the status quo of this system. It's a revenue-neutral bill, but it clarifies something that's been, in my opinion, hopelessly ambiguous for at least the last 5 or 6 years, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Furrier, so then this is an all-inclusive list. There's no, you're not going to add anything else. It's not all, or including but not limited to language. It is, this is the list. Everybody's on notice. Everybody has an opportunity to meet the requirements here.
They do, and there's still an escape clause if they're unaware of or uninformed of the requirement. That's unchanged from the old statute. If after this August 1st deadline, an assessor's office determines that they would like to see actual leases of tenants at the property, they can request it. However, then you're kind of under a Rule 37 Rules of Civil Procedure regime as opposed to automatic dismissal with prejudice. And most of the litigation has focused on production of leases recently, and this does a great job of making that a completely separate, separate sort of disclosure regime, more akin to discovery than compulsory disclosure with mandatory dismissal as the sanction.
All right. Thank you. We also have with us Lisa Han Cordes from
yes.
Hennepin County. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I have been an attorney with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office for a number of years, doing property tax valuation cases for about 9, and speaking here today, representing our office, the County Attorney's Association as well, and would like to mirror what Mr. Furia has said. We have worked cooperatively with the Bar Association and the assessors in the County Attorney's Association to try to come up with language which is clearer and more definitive, and all the parties agree that we can live with this language, and we hope that this language is adopted.
Thank you. And Mr. Baker, Stephen Baker from Ramsey County Assessor's Office, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Stephen Baker. I'm the assessor for Ramsey County and serve on the Legislative Committee for MAAO and I'm also Vice President of the Association. I would mirror what's been said by everyone else here today, particularly what Nick said about that, the scope of this, and really our goal was that this revision to this statute would maintain the status quo. And that was an important premise for assessors, and we're very pleased that it does that. And we recognize that there was a need to provide some clarification for the taxpayers and for the bar. So, I think this is a good compromise in that regard, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Skoy, the Department of Revenue says that this bill increases understandability for taxpayers and reduces compliance costs for taxpayers. And everybody seems to like it. I'd say good bill, vote yes. What do you think?
Well, that would be right, Madam Chair. I would hope that the effort that the folks have put into this would pay off, and that this could get passed into law this year for them to clarify the conditions and the information required.
Senator Skoy, I thank you for your work on this bill. Members, without objection, I'd like to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax policy bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. So moved. Members, we do have to be done in a few minutes. Senator Bach, you think? Well, he's not here. Senator Howe? Senator Howe.
Madam Chair.
You ask a lot of questions, and some members may have a few questions for you today.
Great. We'll probably refer to members of this committee to answer some of those questions, because what Senate File 1012 does is it repeals changes that were made in the 2010 remittance changes requiring accelerated payments. It still retains the June and July accelerated payments required under current law. So what this does is it repeals the accelerated payments that is required of certain vendors, certain businesses that have over $120,000 or more in sales use taxes. So if it does not have a fiscal impact. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Are there members' questions or comments? Senator Howell, there is a fiscal note. You've seen that. It does not show any state impact. And it is intended just to simplify what has become overly complicated with these payments. Is that your intent?
Correct, Madam Chair. There's been significant confusion around the changes that were made in 2010, and this will just repeal those changes.
Thank you. Again, questions or comments from members? Are there folks here that would like to testify either for or against Senator Howell's bill, Senate File 1012? Seeing none, Senator Howell moves that Senate File 1012 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Policy Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. I should have banged that left. There you go. You pass, Senator Howell. Thank you. Senator Bach? Okay. We are very pressed for time, Senator Bach, but you're very welcome to present your bill, and if we have to hold over until next week, we will, but we'll try and help you here today.
Madam Chair, Senate File 660 is a problem unique to a small number of communities in Minnesota. But first, I have the A110365 amendment that actually gets the bill into shape. What it does is it deletes references to the department developing a program for sales tax collections. The department is already doing that work. So what this actually does is the department amendment, they suggested it to delete some redundant language in the bill that they're already doing.
Okay. So
I move the 0365.
Senator Bach moves the 0365 to put the bill in the shape that he would prefer. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. 0365 is adopted.
Just briefly, this was brought to me by the city of Hermantown. The city of Hermantown is a suburban community to the city of Duluth. And the city of Hermantown, I believe, has four zip codes in their city. And they share zip codes with the city of Duluth. And there is a problem with the remittance of the local option sales tax, where some of the sales tax money, if you only use the five-digit zip code, there's a question of whether the money, who the business should remit the money to, the department, the city of Hermantown, or the city of Duluth. So this asks the department to do a study to determine how many cities we have these multiple zip codes in that have local option sales taxes. I know that's also the case in St. Cloud. It's also the case in Mankato, North Mankato. So, Madam Chair, I don't want to take any more of the committee's time. I have the finance manager from the city of Hermantown here that can explain their situation much better than I can.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Tucker.
Yes, Madam Chair, and hello, senators on the committee. I'll just go through real quickly. This is something that came to my awareness when I moved into Hermantown. I moved from Northwest Minnesota, and first thing was that when I went to do a change of address, into Hermantown, the post office changed my address to Duluth. Hermantown, like Senator Bach had mentioned, has four zip codes. 55811 was just Duluth, 55814, which is a federal prison that is in Hermantown, 55810, that is in Proctor, and then 55701, which is Adolph, which is in Hermantown, but the post office calls it Duluth. And so we have a mixture of our addresses in the city of Hermantown that people are using, and a lot of that because of how the post office drives it. And so then when someone is purchasing an item, necessarily their information might not say Hermantown because of the postal service. And I think all of this, another reason where this came out is that I built a house in Hermantown, and I started reviewing my invoices. And according to the law, anything that is delivered into Hermantown or services provided in Hermantown, then it is Hermantown local sales tax. And I was seeing where I was being overcharged one invoice after another. And then when I would discuss this with the businesses, then they seemed to be unaware or didn't care or would give me a credit. But then when I pressed on them and asked them, are you going to process this properly and send it to the state for Hermantown, and they would not commit to this. And so we have been trying to do some public announcements and so on else in communicating with our residents. I even had a business that was in Hermantown that made a delivery to a resident in Hermantown, and because of their software system only recognizes 5 digits, they were charged Duluth tax. And I think in terms of any deliveries that are coming into Hermantown or services, and when companies are using the 5 digits, Hermantown would never collect its local sales tax because Hermantown does not have its own zip code. And that's why this 9 digits is very, very critical. If you had any power to give us our own zip code, that would be wonderful. But the 9 digits would ensure that what is due to be collected for Hermantown is actually given to Hermantown.
Thank you, Ms. Tucker.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Are there questions or comments from members in the committee? Did I cut you off, Ms. Tucker? I didn't mean to. Please forgive me.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just wanted to mention that we have been blessed to have incredible growth, and there has been so much in terms of new housing, new homes that have been built in Hermantown. And because of my own personal experience, I believe that we have lost the local sales tax from those new homes in the construction that was not brought into Hermantown. And with the 9 digits, that certainly would help in our situation.
Madam Chair, the department does. The department does have a policy where 9-digit zip codes are what is intended to be used. It's in their sales tax instructions to businesses, but the vendors that businesses contract with oftentimes only use 5 digits. So what ends up, it really isn't that the law isn't currently adequate. It's that some of the vendors that actually do the sales tax remittance to the state don't use the 9 digits that the department asks them to. So I think this problem might be a little bigger than just Hermantown. And I do recognize the fact that this does cost. The department put a fiscal note on this of $68,000, and I would, and I believe the House is carrying a provision in their tax bill that has a lower fiscal note. And I don't know the reason for that, but if there's some work that can be done on the language to lower the cost, I certainly would be supportive of that. I recognize this committee's limited ability to fund things that cost money.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Mr. Mossman is here from the department, and he might like to address this issue.
Madam Chair and Senators, and I appreciate Senator Bach pointing out that we already do have some work that we do in this area. Just to be clear, we actually have a calculator on our website that all businesses and all taxpayers can use, and in some examples where people have contacted us, we can, in a matter of a very short time, frankly, put in the 9-digit zip code and get exactly where the sales tax should be going. And the vendors that businesses use have access to that same information if they download it and use it, and we update that quarterly. So we appreciate being aware, obviously, of this issue. And as we kind of have indicated to the senator yesterday as well, you know, we'll do work on this. But what we would much prefer is if there's a way that we can, frankly, just find a solution to make sure that this gets done without actually having to do a study. We'll take a look at that in the next few weeks also, because ideally we'd just like to fix it where it's going on.
Questions from the committee? If not, the chair indicated she wanted the bill laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate Bill 660 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, the committee business is done, and we're adjourning until May 4th, I believe, next Wednesday at 8:30 a.m. That committee's adjourned.